So today I am lucky enough to be joined on the phone by musician, singer, songwriter and producer Midjour. We're going to be talking about his upcoming Irish tour and also a little bit about his amazing career. So hi Midj, welcome to the show.
No, thank you.
So let's start off chatting about this tour of yours. It's called Something From Everything Tour. So do you want to maybe tell us a little bit about the whole concept, what people can expect on the night?
Sure, it kind of does what it says on the tin, you know, something from everything. I've looked back, which I'm not very good at doing. I'm not good at looking back over the old stuff because you can always pick holes in it.
Yeah.
So I've looked back over all the stuff from when I thought that I started having some kind of creative input in music. So all the way back to 1978, which is The Rich Kids. And then through Visage from late 70s, early 80s, then through Ultravox, and then through all the solo stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be interesting to choose a track or two from each one of those albums that I've done during that period, which is something like 14, 15 albums.
Yeah.
And put a show together that features songs there that still stand up, that still are relevant and resonate today, and put them all together in one show. So it's quite simply that.
Yeah. It must be difficult to choose, though. When you've got such a huge back catalogue, it must be so difficult to single
really
out
songs. Not really picky like me. it's funny. It's like, we don't all have, you know, a wealth of albums behind us,
yeah.
But we all have photo albums. So if you look back far enough at any of your old photo albums, there's going to be moments where you think, you know, I looked quite cool, and that's all right, that still works. But most of it, you're going to go, oh, what was I thinking? You know, and it kind of, music's the same. You know, you look back at it, and hopefully it's a sign of progress. You look back and you think, I'm not quite sure what I was thinking when I did that. And you shouldn't be. You know, you're much older and wiser and moved on, and you think differently and you act differently. So when you go back to some of the old stuff, some of it you kind of get a bit depressed about. But on the other hand, some of it you're really quite elated that it still works. It still resonates today.
Wow. George here, Midge. Great to talk to you.
Hi, George.
Great to talk to you. How are you?
I'm great.
Looking back over 14 albums worth of material, I mean, for me, as a fan, it must be a bit like Mission Impossible, kind of choosing one or two songs from each album. How do you do it? What's that process?
Well, how you're going to play the music kind of dictates what will work and what won't. So if I was going out with a, you know, full-blown, you know, massive, you know, all-singing, all-dancing band, you know, just about anything is approachable. But I'm coming out doing this with a couple of young multi-instrumentalist musicians, and it's mainly acoustic, so we cover all sorts of stuff from, you know, violin to, you know, mandolins to guitars, and I've now got a little bit of keyboards involved in this as well, so we can play some of these songs. So the way you're going to perform it kind of dictates which songs will work and which don't. I mean, besides the ones that you instantly dismiss because you don't think they work as songs anymore. So the ones that I've chosen, we started off with something like 40 songs and worked our way through them and discarded some as we went and put some in the back pocket for when we want to change the show around.
Yeah.
And we have the core bunch of songs that we have been working on this tour for the last 4 or 5 months that work, and it seems to appeal to everyone, which is great.
And this is the India Electric Company we're talking about, Midge.
Yeah, who are a band in their own right, the India Electric Company. And what I do when I do my little one-man acoustic shows, here and throughout Europe, is I give the opening slots to up-and-coming artists because it's incredibly difficult for new artists to get in front of an audience.
Yeah.
It's really hard these days. So I have a variety of different venues. I use different opening acts. And every time the electric company opened up for me, unbeknownst to me it was them, but my ears would prick up and I'd have to stick my head out the dressing room and see who was making this noise. And it just seemed obvious that these guys, that we could collaborate and work together.
Yeah.
So Indie Electric do their own opening spot and then come off and change the shirts and come back on with me, and I make them work really, really, really hard.
Taskmaster.
No better man. They're a really talented duo, Midge. I've seen bits of them on YouTube, and you guys work so well together.
Well, it's funny, when you find something that gels like that, why would you just throw it away at the end of one tour?
Yeah,
we did a tour a year or so ago, which went on for about 6 months, where we played an entire album live. We did the Breathe album, which I put out about 20 years ago, which was very organic, and, you know, had Paddy Maloney on it, and, you know, Liam from Hothouse Flowers and stuff. So it was very, very organic and Celtic. And these guys were the perfect guys to go out and perform that album live with. And at the end of the tour, it was like coming to the end of a lollipop. You know, we were having such a good time that I kind of said, okay, well, let me have a think about how we could move this on and take this further. And that was the Something From Everything tour.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, do you find you're touring sort of more extensively these days? I mean, I know you're off to Australia next month. Do you enjoy the whole touring process? I know it suits some people, and some people it's kind of they do it because they have to.
I think I never underestimate an audience, ever.
Yeah.
You know, I've come up with a really horrible conclusion recently, and that is that you've got to think of your audience as, you know, at least the moment you walk on stage, 50% of the audience don't want to be there.
Yeah.
Because they've been dragged along by their significant other halves, right? So that's the audience that you want to get.
Yeah.
They're the ones that you want to impress, because they don't really know your stuff. They might know the odd hit. You know, they're sitting there under duress. So you've really got to kind of swing it for them. So I never underestimate an audience. So I'm already thinking 50% of these people don't want to see me. So you cannot walk on and paint by numbers.
Yeah.
You can't walk on and pretend that you're enjoying it. If you don't enjoy it, go and do something else. You know, these people work long and hard to get the money to buy the ticket to come and see you, and they do not want to see you, you know, pacing it out, you know, just blocking out a set. So I thoroughly enjoy what I do. You know, I did a thing on television recently where they send you back to your roots and they film you walking around the streets where you used to, you know, grow up. And they sent me back to Glasgow. And I've been doing this nonstop since I left Glasgow back in the mid-70s. I go back not for nostalgia's sake, but to remind me of what I wanted and what I wished for.
Yeah.
And that I've been so incredibly lucky to get that. Mm. So I do a job that most of us, and you, that most of us would cut off our right arms to have. You know,
absolutely.
It's the best job in the world.
I went to see Image a couple of years ago in the Sugar Club here in Dublin.
Oh, right, yeah, I remember.
It was an amazing night. It was a Sunday night and the place was packed. And that doesn't happen very often, I can tell you. But the back was
really
packed, the sides were packed.
It was an amazing night.
Thank you so much for that. It was fantastic. It was wonderful.
Thank
it was
you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
I did try and sing along, but I don't have much of a voice, Mitch. Sorry.
I was speaking to Ricky Warwick the other day, who's obviously singing with Black Star Riders, you know, the old Thin Lizzy guy.
Yes.
And he was at the show as well, he told me, but he was too shy to come up and say hello. And I thought, oh, for God's sake, you're a rocker. You're covered in tattoos. You can't be too shy to come up and say hi, you know.
Yeah. No, it was. It was a couple of hours of just you and your guitar, and we did have a sing-along. But I was amazed, Midge, by the amount of young people who were there. There was a good 10, maybe 12 people around me who were probably 30 or younger. Do you think you've now got to the point in your career where you're developing now a whole new audience for yourself?
It's funny, because I think the general conception is that an artist can do that.
Mm.
And it's not quite true. You know, all I do is write and record and create things that I think are interesting. I can't think of demographics, and I can't think of age groups, and I can't think that now is the time to go out there and find an entire new audience. Kids and, you know, young people are incredibly smart. They find things that they like, not necessarily find things that they're kind of force-fed. So with the advent of the internet and YouTube and all of that stuff, people can scan through this stuff. And young people have networks. When they find a piece of music they find interesting or a video they find interesting, irrespective of where it's from, how old it is, or what genre music it's meant to be, they send it to their friends. So you get this natural little network happening. There's a thing, an odd thing happened to me recently. Back in the 80s, I was asked to do a cover version of a favourite song for a not very good movie that came out. And I took this opportunity to go and record David Bowie's Man Who Sold the World, which I was a song that I loved. And I gave it to them, and the movie came out and disappeared, and the album came out and disappeared. And recently, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, this lovely man from Japan turned up at one of the Ultravox concerts and said, look, I'm a huge fan. You know, I design and direct and create video games. And this guy happened to be a guy called Hideo Kojima, who made Metal Gear Solid, which is a huge selling game. And he wrote his entire final episode installment of this game, this series of games, based on my version of that song.
So, amazing.
To cut a long story short, recently I've had people, young people from all around the world, contacting me saying, I absolutely love what you're doing, let alone the song was recorded back in 1982. They've discovered it on a game, and they are now fans, and they've now discovered an entire wealth of music that they had no idea existed. And that's how this stuff works.
There's so many ways, isn't there, now, of finding music. You know, as you said, people are finding it through games. And it's just incredible the way the internet.
It's incredible, I mean, you know, we used to depend on radio to kind of educate us on what was out there. You know, you'd spend half your life in record shops asking them to put various albums on, and you'd stand in a booth and listen to the album to find out whether you were willing to part with your money. But that was our musical education. Now everything that's ever been recorded is on the internet.
Yeah.
It's there. It's available. It's like a huge library. So if you're interested in music, it's all there.
Yeah, it's kind of scary, isn't it?
I was just about to ask you, Midge, how important is social media for you? Does it work for you?
I think it's important these days. Mm. I worry about where music is heading and how we get there. You know, especially over the last 15, 20 years, where our music industry has been, you know, decimated by, file sharing, people not paying for music. And it's the one commodity that we have in our world that can actually change our lives. And we don't want to pay 75p or, 100 cents or whatever it is for a piece of music that can actually change your life. It's something you'll take with you to your grave.
Absolutely.
And it's a really odd scenario. So I've been worrying about the diminishing returns on music, because without the funding, without the wherewithal, all new music could just grind to halt, and old music will be available for free, and that doesn't make us move forward. But what's happened is, the interesting thing, I think, is that young artists are now absolutely up on the social media.
Yeah.
So maybe now, instead of looking for the greatest guitarist ever to join your band, you're looking for someone who can play, but they're also really good at dealing with social media, or they're really good at promoting, or they're really good at home recording.
Yeah.
Because all of those skills are absolutely necessary now for any young artist. You have to be a jack of all trades. It's absolutely necessary for any young artist to try and stick the head above the parapet and make, earn a living, enough money to carry on making music.
Yeah.
It's been a really busy decade for you, Midge, this one so far. You've put two albums out. There was the brilliant album in May 2012, and then that was followed by your own solo album, Fragile. Now, on that is a piece of music. It's 7 minutes long. It's an instrumental, wire and wood, and it's incredibly cinematic. I think it's one of the best things you've done. Is there any kind of inkling in you to go and do maybe a full soundtrack?
I've done a couple of soundtrack things in the past, George, and it's a long, laborious process. I love doing it. It's great because it's kind of like wearing a different hat. You're not writing 3-minute pop songs.
Yes,
You know, it's a whole different thing. The parameters that you put upon yourself musically seem to disappear, and you can do anything. when it comes to doing movie soundtracks. So it's something I really enjoy, but unfortunately, the ones that I've done, you know, they've been shoestring budgets. So you end up spending as much time and effort and creativity, you know, going into a soundtrack that might be on a, you know, one of these movies that goes straight to DVD or worse, and it seems a bit soul destroying. Yeah. So if the right opportunity came along, and it's something Ultravox have always said, you know, if the right opportunity, the right vehicle, the right approach came along, and it was something we were interested in, why wouldn't we do it? Because, as you say, what we do and what I do is very cinematic. Yes. Anyway, it's mind movies that we make. You know, we make audio versions of movies. So hopefully you listen to a piece of music that I've done, and you get lost in that piece of music, and you create your own images in your head. So each individual has their own little movie running. You know,
I mean, I'm 51, so I can well remember when there was no such thing as music videos and MTV. And you'd hear these songs on the radio, and you'd get these little videos in your head because we had nothing else. And that was part of the process, I think.
It was part of the process. I remember doing the exact same thing myself, you know, listening to, you know, David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust album or whatever. It was music that took you out of the reality you were in. And isn't that what music's great at? You know, no matter how rubbish your life might be at that moment in time, you can put on a piece of music and it just takes you away from it.
As far as collaboration is concerned, Midge, you've collaborated with quite a few people. Some of my favourite bands, Schiller and Experience, you've worked with as well, and Moby too, who I love. Is there anybody that you haven't collaborated with yet that you'd love to?
You know, you hear people, you come across people, you think, wouldn't it be interesting if? But I'm a firm believer that proper collaborations only happen between, you know, a kind of reciprocal respecting artists. So. Yeah. You know, you could sit down and make a list of people that you'd like to work with, but if they don't like what you do, it's not going to happen. There's record companies that put that kind of collaboration thing together. All the stuff that I have done so far has been out of mutual respect. So it's all worked. I mean, I'd love to do something with Sigur Rós, the Icelandic band.
Oh, they're great. Yeah.
I think there are elements of what they do, maybe elements of what you know, even Radiohead have done, that are stemmed or steeped in what Ultravox used to do back in the 80s. So there are people that you think, you know, if the opportunity came up, yeah, of course, you know, if I found it interesting, I'd love to do it. But it's not something I sit and make plans about. You know, I've never really made plans ever. I don't have a list of people that I'm going to go up and attack and say, right, I need to work with you now. You need to work with me.
You know, just looking back on the 80s, Midge, what made that decade so special?
I'm asked this question a lot. You know, why are the 80s still, you know, resonating with people now? And I think you have to look back. You know, the 80s, it wasn't all great. You know, it was a great period for certain things. We had, you know, the end of the 70s, beginning of 80s, we had a technological revolution. So, you know, for the first time ever, you could buy a synthesizer or a drum machine without having to sell your house to buy it, or without having to, you know, have the thing take up your entire living room just to house it, because you know, up until the Japanese started manufacturing synthesizers, synthesizers were stupidly expensive and you know, incredibly complex things to operate. So we had a technological revolution happening, and then we had, I suppose, a series of artists and writers who of a certain age, who would have been brought up listening to whatever the radio kind of force-fed them when they were kids. So in the 80s, realistically, if you're in your early 20s, you were listening to whatever, you know, in my case, the BBC were playing at me. So everything from Frank Sinatra to the start of the Mersey sound, you know, the Beatles and the Stones and Jerry and the Pacemakers and all of that stuff. So we were all brought up on, you know, really well-constructed melodic pop songs. interesting pieces of music. Mm. We all grew up through the rock era and the blues era, and you know, just this mishmash of musical influences. So that by the time the 80s appeared and people started writing songs, for whatever reason, we had this incredible batch of really good songwriters, you know, from ABC to Japan, you know, from Heaven 17 to, you know, Spandau Ballet. We just had this wealth of brilliant songwriters. And it was an era when song was king. You know, it wasn't just about the production. It wasn't just about the instrumentation. It was about the song. And those songs are still alive and kicking today, you know, on the internet and on, you know, golden oldies radio stations and whatever all around the world. So they're still there doing their job just the same way the songs of the 60s are still getting played today.
Does it concern you, Midge, that kids now might be more inclined to go and pay their few bob to see somebody with a laptop rather than a live band?
Well, I think we've been, you know, there are, you know, again, there's divisions in music. Mm. I was talking to some people in London about this just yesterday, talking about, you know, going to see, you know, Little Mix. And you go and see Little Mix and there's not a musician on stage. Nothing. It's all done to backing track. You know, there are no musicians there. I've seen that before with a lot of the boy bands and a lot of the girl bands, because it seemed to change, you know. It became, to be in a band, I always found it a bit odd that these kids would say, yeah, I'm in a band. You think, well, no, you're not. You're in a bunch of singers or dancers or whatever it is. A band, surely, part of the terminology of being in a band is that you play something in the band, and it just seemed to deviate somewhat from that. I'm glad to say it's gotten back on track now, you know, more often than not. When you go and, you know, when you take your kids to see some of these young bands, they are actually standing there playing, so it's gone back to that because it's important that that happens. But yeah, I don't agree with, you know, going along and watching something that it sounds phenomenal because it's all been done in the studio. You know, Ultravox always performed live. You know, I can play you the mistakes. You know, I've still got the recording. But it was live and it was raw, but it was electronic. We refused to use backing tracks, yeah, or pre-programmed tapes or anything like that. So I think a performance, and as I said before, an audience isn't stupid. People can tell, you know, you go along and see something, you can tell when you get that tingle and that buzz, and it's because someone has gone for the note, someone has pushed themselves and hit that high note or played something beautiful on a guitar or keyboard or whatever, and that's what resonates with people, that's what makes your spine tingle.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, your career spans an amazing, like, 40 years, so it's crazy, in, you know, in this day and age. I mean, how did it all start for you? Were you, I'm assuming you're interested in music, you know, passionately as a kid?
Yeah, radio, that was it. You know, I was born in a tenement slum in the outskirts of Glasgow, so we had no, you know, television as such to speak of until I was, you know, nearly in double figures. But we had a radio. So radio, as I said, used to play all sorts at me, so everything from, you know, Mantovani to, you know, to Scottish folk music.
Yeah.
So we were just given this very, you know, absurd collection of music. So it was always there. I remember as a kid, you know, my mother would be cleaning the house, which is kind of the job that she had at the time. And the music was always in the background. The radio was constantly playing. So by the time a television came along and I saw people on, you know, on television with guitars around their necks, there was something absolutely fascinating about, you know, owning a guitar. And also, you know, I thought it would make me incredibly, you know, appealing to the opposite sex, which it did for a while.
Yeah, I mean, were you in a band at school? Is that how you started?
No, when I started, the only place I could go with my guitar when I finally, you know, plagued my parents to get me one, was the folk club at secondary school.
Right.
And I was never into folk music, really. In fact, it was everything I was trying to avoid. The only real music lessons you would get at school would be, you know, Scottish traditional folk music.
Yeah.
And so the only place I could go and meet other people who had guitars was at the folk club. And, of course, it only takes one person that you kind of connect with. and the two of you will sit and, you know, spend hours in each other's, you know, bedrooms playing Beatles songs over and over and over, trying to work out the chords. And before you know it, there are three of you. And then before you know it, you know someone who's got a drum and a cymbal. So, that you know, then you've got yourself your first band, and you're still in your, you know, early teens.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it happens. Like-minded people will just, you know, levitate towards each other.
Yeah. I mean, we can't talk to you and not talk about the whole Band-Aid thing. I mean, you must have great memories of those days.
Yeah, I do. It's funny because, now, at this late stage, it kind of feels like somebody else did it. You know, I remember being there and remember all the elements of it, but it was such a a wild whirlwind of a time. You know, it was we had created this huge thing that was just taking off and had to be kind of controlled and manipulated, and it was intense, to say the least. So now, looking back at it, I see it more as a moment in history that I happened to be privy to, happened to be there kind of looking in on. But of course, I was there in the middle of it all, hands on doing it. Still am hands on doing it, after 32 years.
Well, it was groundbreaking, wasn't it, at the time? Do you know what I mean? No one had really done anything like that before, and it was the first time anything like that had been done.
Yeah, I think that the first piece of advice we ever got from anyone about doing Band-Aid came from George Harrison, who had tried to do something similar with the concert for Bangladesh. And he did a big concert, and it was televised, and there was a big live album from it, and the money was all eaten up in overheads. Yeah. And George said to us, "Get yourselves good accountants and make sure that." It was the best advice we ever had, because I didn't want to touch any of the finances that were coming in.
Oh, God.
So we needed advice, and we were given, the best advice we could possibly get. So it was a scary thing to do, but it spawned many other, aid type events, Farm Aid and.
Yeah.
Lots of things, a whole pile of things came out afterwards.
The day itself, Midge, the recording of Do They Know It's Christmas must have been amazing for everybody involved, because anybody who was anybody within the music industry at that time was there in one place on the same day. And it must have been phenomenal to have a look around and see Spandau Ballet in the same room as Duran Duran.
They're pushing each other out the way of the mirror to put the makeup on. That's what was going on.
And Karen and
told. It was. But there was also, I think there's a fallacy in the music industry that everyone thinks you know everybody else, and more often than not, you've seen them in the magazines or you've seen them on television, but you don't actually know them, So it was the first time I met Bono, in that room, and U2 were a kind of up and coming college band at the time. They'd started cracking America, but they were still playing, regular gigs and doing the gig circuit over here. So. It was an interesting combination, but I have to say everyone was on best behaviour. Everyone just waited patiently for their turn, because I think they were as scared as we were. There is nothing more scary than walking in ready to sing a song at 8 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is, having had a wild night out the night before, with a camera stuck in your face.
Yeah.
Singing a song you've never heard, it's easy. Now you can email a song to someone and they can learn it on the way there. But people were walking in cold to hear the song for the first time. And not only were they singing it in front of a camera with a croaky voice and a hangover, but all their contemporaries were standing there watching them.
Yeah.
So you imagine a sea of all your contemporary artists all standing at the control room window watching you, croak your way through a song you've never sung before. That is intimidating. That's the ultimate in intimidation. But everyone was incredibly good and gave everyone else the support that they needed. It was fantastic.
And did you ever think for one moment that it would go on to become one of the biggest selling singles ever? And still charts to this day. I think it made the top 40 this Christmas as well. It must be fantastic to see that.
It's amazing. I think I had an inkling the day after that day we've just been talking about. We had 24 hours in the studio to do all the vocals, Phil Collins' drums, and mix the record, because in those days the record had to go, the tapes had to go straight to the pressing plants to start pressing the vinyl. And that took a while. It wasn't an overnight job. So we had a deadline to get the tapes in, otherwise the record wouldn't be ready in time for the stores, for the shops for Christmas, which meant the whole thing was just, there was no point in doing it if that was the case.
Yeah.
So the moment we finished mixing the song, Bob took a cassette in a taxi to BBC Radio 1 for the breakfast show. And I got in my car, very tired, having stayed up all night doing this. I got in my car and started driving home, and I heard Bob on the radio. And the breakfast show played the cassette.
Wow.
And the moment the cassette finished, they rewound it, and they played it again. And that never, ever happened. Not only the BBC playing a cassette was unheard of, but they'd never played a song twice. You know, at this point, it had no serial number, it had no code, it had nothing. It was a cassette. And I realised then that this was something quite unique that was happening, you know.
And when was that? 1985, wasn't it?
Not that. It was 84. The Christmas of 84, yeah. was when the song came out.
And there's been subsequent versions as well. I think you did one with Stock Aitken Waterman back in 88.
Yeah, I didn't do that. Another two. I'm just flagging that up. I didn't do that.
You didn't do that. No, you didn't.
And, I wasn't even in the country.
Good man yourself. And there was another version as well that came out a few years back, which was kind of brought up to date. And I loved it. I think it's a great song. And it's a song without a chorus. Am I right?
It's a song without a chorus. How bizarre is it?
Yeah.
You have to wait to the very end to get the kind of sing-along bit. But that's just what happens when you kind of construct a song, you know, with two songwriters that have never actually worked together before. You know, Bob and I had known each other for many years, but we'd never actually sat down and tried to do anything remotely artistic. And you know, we're very, very different characters, working from the, you know, different areas of music. But we managed to pull something off that was palatable.
I'd say maybe the BBC had to play that cassette twice. Knowing Air Bob.
Poor old Simon Bates probably had no say in the matter.
And, Midge, you're back to us at the end of the month. Have you got the dates in front of you? You can tell us about them.
God, is this a test?
I've got the dates, Midge. I've got the dates. Don't
Paula
worry about
it.
Thank goodness one of us is semi-pro.
Yes, well, you've got to be these days, haven't you? So, basically, we've got Wednesday the 22nd, you're in the Waterfront in Belfast. The 23rd, Cork Opera House. 24th, in the Town Hall.
Galway.
Town Hall in Galway. Fantastic theatre. Really, really nice. Then you're in Dublin. You come over to us. Pavilion Theatre on the 25th. And then the Helix, finishing in the Helix on the 26th. So, yeah, weekend in Dublin.
I lived in Dunleary for a little bit.
Yeah.
I lived there for a month, a few doors down from Paul McGuinness. So I was in Millionaire's Row.
I mean, do you get to take in much of the sights? Do you get any time to sort of be a bit of a tourist when you're on tour?
Yeah, I've spent quite a bit of time in Dublin with my kind of Irish connections.
Yeah.
You know, I've been over there, you know, doing the U2 thing and, you know, hanging out with Philip Lynott and, you know, all of that. So I've spent quite a bit of time in Dublin. So I've managed to see probably more of it than the tourists get to see. So I've seen the back streets.
We won't talk about that.
Just a word, Midge, on last year you very bravely went to the States all on your own, and you did a tour of America just yourself. And
I did,
that must have been pretty daunting.
I did it for a reason. I was a guest speaker at LIPA, which is the Liverpool Institute of Performing Arts, the school that Paul McCartney and Sir George Martin put together, a kind of, you know, fame-type arts school. And they asked people to come and do master classes, and they asked me to come along and be interviewed on stage in front of the aspiring writers and producers and whatever they have there. And I'm happy to do that. I love doing that stuff. And And as I was answering all the questions were all about, you know, multi-album deals and, you know, record deals and, you know, global touring and, you know, all of that stuff. And I'm answering all the questions. And it struck me towards the end of this session that the majority of people, not only in that room, but the majority of people who are sitting in rooms similar in colleges all around the world, all hoping to break into the music industry, might never, ever experience any of what I was talking about, because it's a bygone age. You know, the days of being signed to, you know, three album record deals or five album record deals don't really exist anymore because of what we talked about earlier, the change in the music industry. So I thought, well, how can I show people just how difficult it might be for them? And I set out doing this tour of America, which I split in two. I did it in 2 3-week sections. And I'd go out to America, and I thought, well, you know, I'll book the dates. That's fine. I've got an agent. He can book the shows for me. But everything else I will do, you know, kind of cap in hand.
Yeah,
I will go out there. I'll book my own flights. I'll carry my guitar. I will have my own T-shirts printed up specifically for the tour. I'll carry my own merchandising.
Yeah.
I'll rent my own cars. I'll book my own motels. I will travel, you know, all over on my own. No crew, no tour manager, nobody with me, just me. And I'll document this, which is exactly what I did. I took a little GoPro camera with me, and I filmed the entire thing. So all these people in America could see me driving past, talking to myself in a car, you know, like some kind of, you know, mad person. And I documented the whole journey of doing this through snowstorms and ice storms and all sorts of stuff, you know, through the heat in California and Florida and whatever. And I'd document simple, stupid things like, you know, I'd send merchandising from its manufacturers to be at a place at a certain day and time. And, of course, I would get to the place to play that night and realize that the merchandising was 50 miles away, which I couldn't get my hands on. But the difference between not having the CDs that night, not necessarily to me, but the difference between having the CDs or not having the CDs on sale that night could have been the difference between making a profit or making a loss on the tour. It's that the margins are that narrow. So I documented all of that to show young people that if you're lucky enough to be able to do a tour like this, this is how you have to do it. You know, to keep your head above water, to enable you to write, record, and make music for, you know, the rest of your life, if you want a career in it. If you're expecting a Learjet and a Lamborghini, it's not going to happen.
It must be quite liberating, though, to do something like that. Just go off and do it yourself. You're kind of in charge of your own, you know, whatever happens, you're kind of policing yourself.
You are policing yourself, and it's a scary thing. I mean, the scariest thing for me was dealing with the money at the end of the night. I'd never done that. You know, not since I was a sporty teenager. You know, someone comes in at the end of the night and they've got a breakdown of how many tickets you sold and how much this cost and how much that cost. And I'm sitting there doing a settlement and I'm thinking, this is what a tour manager does. I've never done this. So someone's trusting me taking cash with money, and I've got no idea what to do with it. So it was a learning curve for me, but I found it fascinating doing it. You know, and America's such a huge place. You'd find yourself sitting driving a car for 6 hours a day and then have to go through the whole process right up until you'd packed away all the stuff at the end of the night, put it back in your car, signed all the autographs, taken the photographs, done the selfies, you know, find yourself going into a motel at 2 o'clock in the morning to get up again at 8 to go and do the same thing again. So unless you're prepared to do that, maybe the music industry isn't for you.
Yeah, would you do it again, though? Now you've done it. Would you say, I won't do
that
again?
I'm not sure I'd do it on my own again. I think it would be interesting doing it with a friend, doing it with another singer-songwriter, another musician, and sharing the experience. But I'm quite good in my own company. I mean, I've spent so long in hotels on my own.
Yeah.
I'm quite good at doing that. Most people would find it quite lonely. I find it quite liberating. I find it quite nice to be there on my own. It's not the sort of thing I would choose to do. If I was 20 again, I would be chomping at the bit to go out there and do that.
Yeah.
But at this late stage in my life, I'm thinking, really? Is that, you know, ooh, you could go on holiday, you know, you could go and lie on a beach somewhere,
yeah.
And, you know. You know what, I think if push came to shove, I probably would do it again.
Is there anywhere, Midge, that you haven't played that you'd love to play? I think I'm right in saying you went to Mexico for the first time a couple of years back. Am I right?
I did, yeah. I mean, weirdly, it transpires that Ultravox were huge in Mexico, even in the 80s, and nobody told us.
Oh, so no.
I was invited to go to Mexico 2 years ago, and it was like the second coming.
Oh,
it
wow.
was really bizarre. I mean, radio stations were just fawning over me. It was like, I don't know, I felt like Bono for a minute. It was really bizarre. You know, all these people had been brought up and, you know, cut their teeth on my music. And it was just, it was great. I mean, it was lovely to do. But what a weird thing that nobody had ever thought to say, you know what, you should try and get a few gigs down there. Because they love you. They know all your songs. So I step on stage and they know every single word of every song I'm singing. And it was just amazing. It was lovely.
Any plans to go back?
I certainly hope so, unless they all thought, well, he wasn't that good, you know. I'm not sure we'd have him back. I will go back at some point. You know, it's a long way to go and do one gig, which is what I did. So if there's something a bit more comprehensive to do, yes, of course. It's the sort of thing you would tie in with an American-Canadian tour and try and do it all in one fell swoop. Yeah. So, yes, of course, it would be great to do that. But there must be the other places around the world. For the last 10 years, I've been working at getting back to territories that used to be very successful for me that I hadn't been to. I hadn't toured for a long time. So Australia, New Zealand, Japan, you know, America, Canada. So I've been moving into, you know, sixth gear here, and I seem to have been incredibly busy for the last few years touring live.
I suppose you've got all the expats as well, haven't you, out in Australia and New Zealand, so you've got a sort of core little fan base there already.
Absolutely, and, you know, in New Zealand especially, you know, a lot of expat Scots down there, and, you know, so, a lot of people want to come and see you, as well as the fact that, you know, Ultravox and myself, we sold an awful lot of records in those territories, so they still have a fondness for you.
And it was great again to see the Rich Kids get back on stage last year, Midge.
That was wild.
What was that like for you?
That was something I didn't plan on at all. I found myself sitting next to Glenn Matlock, the founder of the Rich Kids and ex Sex Pistol bass player. I found myself, Glenn and I went to the Q Awards a couple of years back, and we're sitting next to each other at the table, and of course those things go on for hours. So, you know, we'd kind of caught up and chatted about all the niceties, and there were just little moments where you thought, oh, one of us should say something. And I said, in one of these breaks, I said, well, you know, now that, you know, Steve New, the guitarist, isn't with us anymore, if we ever did another gig, you know, who would you think we should maybe use on guitar? And, of course, that sparked off this whole avalanche of ideas let's try and do one. Let's try and do a show. And that wasn't the intention. It just kind of, once you've kind of, you know, talked about the elephant in the room, it kind of becomes a kind of reality, you know, a bit like Ultravox getting back together again.
Once it
was mentioned and kind of sat in your head, even though you'd said never for years, once it got into your head, you thought, well, that's possible. That could actually happen. So it was great fun. I mean, it's a pity we only did the one show. But we had Gary Kemp from Spandau came in and did guitar with the Rich Kids. And it was just such a vibey, fun, wild, you know, kind of rock pop night. It was lovely.
Just getting back to the old days, Midge, I can remember buying the single back in 1977 and getting home and taking it out of the bag and being mesmerised by the fact that it was in red vinyl.
Red vinyl, I know.
Wow.
It never really happened. I think we we started a revolution at that point, because everyone had to have clear or coloured or picture vinyl after that. Because I remember sitting with the head of EMI, who had signed the Rich Kids, and they were talking about the first record coming out, and I had said, well, surely couldn't we do it in coloured vinyl? And they said, what do you mean? I've never seen coloured vinyl. And I said, well, kids' nursery records, you know, little EPs and things that you get for children are pressed up in coloured vinyl. And they went off and they found out about this, and it was a little hand pressing plant somewhere that would do these pink vinyl records. So we were one of the first to do that. And of course the record companies saw it as a huge marketing plan. So every record for the next couple of years, the first 50,000 would come out on coloured or clear or picture vinyl or luminous vinyl or whatever it was, you know.
Yeah.
So sorry about that.
Collector's item.
Oh, that thought you were fantastic. It just brings back memories of the old music press, like Smash Hits and the Record Mirror and Sounds and Melody Maker.
That's
and
right,
Top of the Pops.
Times.
That's gone as well.
What have we got now? There's nothing, is there, really?
It just seems...
Yeah, you get clear MP3s. That's what you get.
That's what you get.
They're so clear you can't see them.
Yeah, but for a band like Ultravox, when you came back with a brilliant album back in 2012, and the last album to that would have been 1986, I think, with the Uvox album, it must have been like walking back into an empty shell of a thing. Is there anything left? You know?
Well, you know, it's funny because... We were reticent to do anything. I mean, when we talked about getting back together, it was simply to tour. Mm. And we knew we could do that. I mean, it would just take a bit of, you know, blowing off a lot of cobwebs and relearning some technology. You know, there's a lot of new technology on stage rather than touring with, you know, 20-odd keyboards on stage. Now you could tour with, you know, two keyboards each and a laptop and still... produce the same sound. It's just technology has changed an awful lot. So once we'd gotten over the technological changes and, you know, got ourselves up to be, you know, fighting fit, you know, match fit, we knew we could go out and perform live. That's fine. It was when we were approached to make a new record that we thought maybe there's nothing left.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to have a bunch of guys who were almost all in their 60s be approached to make a new album for a major record label was a major thing for us. I turned it down.
Yeah.
I said no, because what if, you know, we can play together, but we can't write together. You know, we'd been apart for 5 times longer than we'd ever been together.
Mm.
And who in the right minds would think that after a break like that, you would still have something in common, so you could still create new things together. So I kind of turned it down, and then, as I said before, the elephant in the room, once the idea is planted in your head, you start talking about, well, if we did it, where could we do it, and how could we do it, and how could we do it without committing to doing it? I don't want to commit to doing something in case it's third rate and the record label had still put it out because they want to try and get the money back and, you know, the cost involved in doing something like this. So there was an awful lot of ifs and buts. But the moment that we decided how and where and when we could do this, the moment we got together, we realized that the spark was still there.
Yeah.
So we were fine. But yes, it was a very scary thing and a very scary thing to commit to. But I was very pleased with the results.
Yeah, be a lot of pressure though, wouldn't there? Do you know what I mean? If you're kind of, you're making an album, not because you really, really want to, like being forced to make a new album. Not forced. Force is the wrong word to use.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's something, it was a step too far for us. You know, we just thought, really? It's a whole different ball game. You know, it's a bit like, you know, asking an older model who had been, you know, big 30 years before to do a photo shoot and then saying, you know what, let's go and do the catwalk now. And you think, whoa, hold on a second, I didn't agree to that. We were just being very trepidatious, I suppose. We've been very tentative about how we were going to do this, if we were going to do it. But as I said, we were very, very pleased with the results, and it was a nice way to get back and just kind of reestablish that, you know, we still thought in a certain way, you know.
Yeah.
I think looking back on the album, I can remember receiving it in here, and playing the album in its entirety in the radio. I think it was the first one to do it. And looking back at it, it's 5 years old, but it's a stunning album, and thank you for it. It's an amazing piece of work.
Thank you. Thanks for being the first to play it all.
Yeah, I enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, so on that note, we've run out of time, unfortunately, but thank you so much for talking to us today, Midge.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a joy.
Thanks, Midge. Fantastic.
So let's give you those tour dates again. If you want to try and catch Midge in Ireland at the end of this month. So Wednesday 22nd, Waterfront in Belfast. Thursday 23rd in the Cork Opera House. 24th of February, Town Hall, Galway. 25th of February in the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, and 26th of on a Sunday, the Helix. And you could do all of them if you wanted to. Just get a little, get yourself a little band of mates in a car and do the whole lot. But thank you so much for talking to us today, Midge.
That's a pleasure. It's been good fun.
Great stuff, Midge. Thanks, Emil. Thank you.